Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine. We have just four features from the May 2023 edition of True West, and these are short features. So we'll begin with these four features, the final one being the column that we read at the end of the month, and that is Ask the Marshal. And finally, after the Ask the Marshal column, we'll read to fill time with archive editions of stories from True West. From May 2023, Don't Bet Against a Sporting Girl, How Soiled Doves Tried to Beat the Odds Against Hypocrisy and Politicians. For several decades, Hollywood has had a fine time portraying shady ladies of the past, from the illustrious Miss Kitty of CBS's Gunsmoke to the disreputable wenches on HBO's Deadwood. Viewers have been given a taste of how prostitutes lived and what they went through. Unfortunately, neither of these shows, nor others like them, portray the prostitution business as it really was, a vicious cycle wherein women with no other way to make money broke the law to sell their bodies for sex, paid off numerous government officials in order to remain in business, and died unrecognized for their unseen, unappreciated good deeds. In reality, such women were viewed as debaucherous troublemakers, homewreckers, and fallen women who lured young men into their lairs and did unspeakable things with them for cash. Rarely did someone happen to point out that the law's habit of collecting money from business establishments that were illegal was in itself a crime. The politics of prostitution were very real during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Brothels were outlawed, and the women working in them paid for fines, fees, business and liquor licenses. Many also paid higher property taxes than other legitimate businesses. Talk was constant about closing down bawdy houses, but most cities were hesitant to try surviving without the monthly income generated from the demi mode. The money was mighty handy for supporting schools, hospitals, and churches, the latter which soiled doves were sometimes forbidden from attending. Throw in a healthy dose of city governments who took the women's money, failed to assist them when they were in need, publicly insulted and laughed at them, and forgot them when they died, and here was the hypocrisy at its finest. It was, after all, easier to reap profits from prostitutes than it was to actually treat them as equals and help them become first-class citizens. Prostitution in America goes back a long way, even before city governments found a way to prey on fallen women and profit by it. Back in 1805, when Meriwether Lewis and William Clark came west, they found that native women appeared more equal in status to their male counterparts. And although native leaders sometimes offered their wives or daughters as gifts or trade to Anglo men, doing so was considered an honor among the tribe. There was no disgrace, no backlash. Not until settlement of the West by white pioneers began was the buying and selling of sex considered naughty. In 1863, Montana's first newspaper editor, Thomas Dimsdale, was in Virginia City where he observed the numerous women of easy virtue who were promenading through the camp. A captivated Dimsdale described them in great detail, as well as the dance halls where they worked and their customers. From all appearances, the ladies received fabulous sums from their purchased favors, according to Dimsdale. But what many women actually did with their money has often been buried under objections to their presence. The whore with a heart of gold. Hundreds of harlots deserve long past due credit for their contributions to schools, churches, the poor, the homeless, needy children, injured and sick laborers, and countless others. Stories about such deeds are numerous. During the 1880s, for instance, when it was finally decided that a church should be erected in Kingston, New Mexico, Madam Sadie Orchard and her friends passed a hat among the saloons and brothels for its construction. The ladies received gold nuggets, jewelry, and cash amounting to $1,500. At Leadville, Colorado, in 1881, newspapers questioned Madam Molly May's motives after she took in a baby while the child's destitute mother contacted relatives for assistance. One newspaper also interviewed Molly, who angrily reminded the general public of all the charities she donated to on a regular basis. Some women donated property as well, or at least tried to. Beginning in 1891, longtime Madam Anna Wilson of Omaha, Nebraska, tried to lease her posh 37-bedroom parlor house to the city to use as a much-needed hospital. City officials mulled the offer for several weeks before ultimately declining the offer. Anna did not give up. Over the next two decades, she gave an elaborate fountain from her private home to a local park, donated $300 to the Child Saving Institute, and in 1911, offered her parlor house for lease once again, this time with the stipulation that the building would bequeath to the city after her death. Omaha officials finally accepted her offer, and the wealthy madam died soon afterwards. Many ladies of the red light occupation willingly shared their wealth, sometimes by law, sometimes by unwritten law, and sometimes on their own. In Tombstone, Arizona, funding for the Episcopal Church was contributed by local gamblers, saloons keepers, and the bawdy women of the town. That did not stop respectable women from soliciting for additional donations from prostitutes. One of them, an employee of the infamous Birdcage Theater, exacted her own revenge. "Them women always looked down their noses at us, excepting when they needed some money for a charity," she recalled. "Then they'd come down and ask us girls. Well, I always donated, but I got my licks in doing it. I'd found out from an old lady that if you used a certain size coin and placed it just right, then you wouldn't get pregnant. Well, when I used them coins, I laid them on the table in my room. Then when the society ladies came down for a donation, I give them the coins on my table." The ladies contributed more than money. As much as wanton women were a soft touch for the down and out, they did have a motive. Simply put, if their hometowns did not do well, the ladies themselves did not do well. Many madams simply took charitable donation matters into their own hands on behalf of their cities, but also their clients, friends, and even local children. Colorado City, Colorado madam Laura Bell McDaniel gave her blind friend Dusty McCarty a job bartending. During the early 1900s, Madam Lee Perry of Silver City, New Mexico, was remembered as a kind-hearted woman who purchased coats for poor children and grub-staked local miners. In Jerome, Arizona, Madam Lil Douglas and her girls bought presents for the local children at Christmas. And let's not forget Silver Heels, the legendary dance hall harlot of Colorado, who risked her own life and became permanently pockmarked while helping during a smallpox epidemic. Perhaps one of the best benefactors in the West was Laura Evans of Colorado, who was the reigning madam of Salida by the early 20th century. Because of her, during the Great Depression, food baskets were found on the doorsteps of families with children. Coal was mysteriously delivered to those in need free of charge. A church in town received a new roof. Railroad men who were hurt on the job would receive less strenuous employment offers while they recuperated. One man recalled recovering from an injury and being offered a job selling newspapers at an unusually high pay. "I didn't learn until long after Laura died that she paid the storekeeper for my salary for more than a year while I got over my pain and learned to use what was left of my hand," the man later recalled. Others remembered how Laura paid young boys to run her errands and instructed them to tell their mothers they earned the money in honest work for a stranger. Abused housewives were sometimes sheltered by Laura, who refused to let them work for her. "I doubt if anybody will ever show how many people Laura helped," said one Salida politician in later years. "She was an entire department of social services long before there was such a thing." The hypocrisies against harlots. Prostitutes and madams were only publicly recognized for their good deeds now and then. At Helena, Montana, in 1865, a local alderman, R.H. Howery, blatantly lectured that all sin and fault is laid at the doors of the women. No charity is expressed for them. Howery also recognized that the prostitution is an evil arising from the vile passions of men that made the women what they are. yet his truth fell on deaf ears. No doubt because the city government was already scheming to make Demonmond their own cash cow in the way of exorbitant fines and property taxes. By the 1890s, nearly all cities had instituted systems that allowed them to collect money from the red light ladies. Policemen, whose beats included the restricted district, quickly figured out how to extract more cash by extorting protection money from the women. In some cases, the madams also supplied complimentary liquor and girls to pay law enforcement and city officials. Other times, police willingly aided the ladies in exchange for pay. Such was the case at Maggie and George Wood's Red Light Saloon in Caldwell, Kansas. In 1880, the couple hired police officer George Reed to perform various odd jobs that likely included serving as a bouncer. 10 years later, the McCook Tribune revealed that certain high-license brothels in far-off Lincoln, Nebraska, were allowed to sell liquor without being required to purchase a license or contribute to the local school fund. It was no secret that women of the Demimonde were fully expected to contribute money to the local nonprofits. In 1893, Sheriff High Wilson told the women working above the Bennett Avenue saloons in Cripple Creek, Colorado, that they must relocate one block south to Myers Avenue. There, he promised the ladies, they could run their businesses freely as long as they paid their fines and donated to the local charities. Although some cities did establish rescue missions for wayward girls, they relied solely on the women to volunteer to be reformed. When Florence Roberts approached a policeman in San Francisco about helping a teenager who was being forced by her own father to sell sexual favors, the officer responded, "I can't interfere. The man has a license. His daughter isn't of age. He's her legal guardian." The girl's father was not the only one making money off women. In Arizona, California, Montana, Oregon, and other states, prominent businessmen, including clergymen, were sometimes identified as the actual owners of brothel properties. The best example of hypocrisy in government was the stockade in Salt Lake City, Utah. In 1907, city officials approached Ogden Madam Dora Toppin, also known as Belle London. Dora had long been known as a most charitable woman who frequently reached out to women and children in need. The city, under Mayor John Bransford, offered Dora an amazing business deal. The madam could pick out a sizable piece of property in Salt Lake City on which to construct a large, legal red light district with parlor houses, cribs, and a saloon, enough to house several hundred prostitutes. Dora accepted. Despite protests by newspapers and citizens, the stockade was constructed within about a year, and a large wall was built around its perimeter. But the operation was immediately besieged with problems, including busting secret holes in the wall and the presence of an underage girl. Accusations were made, lawsuits were filed, and Dora was served to appear in court by the very city who had hired her for the job. The genteel lady suffered myriad illnesses at the mere thought of being jailed, as newspapers and the general public blamed and shamed her. Among those to defend Dora was Reverend Noble Strong Elderkin, who urged the repeal of the laws against vice and lawbreaking to save citizens from hypocrisy, and denounced Salt Lake for its discourteous treatment of Belle London. 6 months later, after having her say in an interview with the Salt Lake Herald, the charges against Dora were dropped. There was another attempt to reopen the stockade, as Dora tried to ingratiate herself to the good women of Salt Lake City and Ogden, but it was no good. The stockade closed permanently in 1911, as Goodwin's weekly newspaper declared that Dora had obviously been railroaded. Even her hometown of Ogden turned on her, and in 1917 she moved to her daughter's home in California and changed her name. The Ogden Standard Examiner brought forth her shameful past by calling her Belle London, when she died in 1924. Thankfully, Dora's friend, D.W. Brown, wrote a letter to the editor pointing out the woman's many kindnesses and how well her daughters turned out. "If you wish to ask any questions concerning this account, drop me a card and I will call at your office," Brown wrote. The Red Light Abatement Act. Frontier prostitution, as it was known, was drawing to a close by 1913 when the state of California introduced the Red Light Abatement Act, which, it was hoped, would put an end to the prostitution industry once and for all. Similar acts would be filed in other states over time, but the problem was that nobody had anything to offer in the way of rehabilitation or finding respectable jobs for prostitutes. While male brothel owners might certainly find other business endeavors and remain successful, prostitutes would be relegated to menial, low-paying jobs. Many of them would remain unemployed, or they were fired, if their prospective employers became aware of their shady pasts. Single and widowed women, and mothers especially, would suffer under impoverished conditions, which was the biggest reason most of them became prostitutes in the first place. Most of the 138 women who were brought into court after San Diego's bawdy, sting-agreed district was closed that November did not believe the local Purity League's promise to help them. The ladies had heard it before, and many of them refused to even give their birth names. One 28-year-old prostitute told officials that she would be glad to quit the sporting life if you could find me a job which would enable me to earn enough to meet my expenses. I have a crippled mother and a young sister to support. The woman went on to explain that she had worked legitimate jobs, but the wages were not enough to keep me alone. The officials had nothing to offer in response. Death of the Demimonde. Today, only a handful of graves for wayward women can be found across the West. More often than not, their relatives, if they were found, were shocked to discover what the woman had really done for a living. Many relatives refused to have anything to do with the disposal of the girls' bodies. This is what happened to Madame Pearl DeVere when she died in Cripple Creek in 1897. Pearl's sister duly came from Indiana to claim the body, but found out that Pearl was not the hat or dressmaker she said she was, and immediately boarded the next train out of town. Redemption for prostitutes and the lives they led was sometimes granted after they died. When Molly Mae died in 1887, a respectable woman, Mindy Lamb, insisted on attending her funeral. Some years before, Molly had stopped Mindy on the street and offered her condolences for the murder of Mindy's husband, Louis. The two formed a friendship, which was apparently kept quiet until Mindy announced she was going to Molly's services. Also, Molly's obituary noted that she was a woman who, with all her bad qualities, was given to charity and was always willing to help the poor and unfortunate. Even Madam Anna Wilson was praised for her efforts to encourage prostitutes to leave the life of the red light, as well as leaving many donations to Omaha's churches, child services, and hospitals when she died. The madam's will also decreed that she be buried under 9 feet of concrete, lest anyone change their mind about where her final resting place should be. In the case of Sammy Dean, a red light lady from Jerome, Arizona, who was murdered in 1931, her family did claim her body and took it back to Texas to be interred in the family plot. Other women from the Demimonde were not treated so kindly upon their deaths. When Tessie Wall, the scrappy Irish madam of San Francisco, died in 1932, some of her money and property was willed to the 10 relatives who survived her. Most of it, however, went to the executor of her estate, Police Captain John J. O'Meara, whom Tessie had known for nearly 40 years. There was little interest in the madam's furnishings, which were considered rather bizarre and garish. When her jewelry, fine art, bedroom sets, furnishings, and a china set, formerly owned by William Rockefeller, were put up for auction, few appeared to bid. Most items sold at amazingly low prices. Most interesting, I found, noted a reporter from the Oakland Tribune, were the men present who watched the sale and said nothing. Likewise, Del Burke of Lusk, Wyoming, was well known for her Yellow House, the brothel she ran for many years. Del died in 1980, long after Lusk's other shady ladies had moved on. But even at that late date, few wanted to have anything to do with Del, including her family. A call to a relative for the writing of Del's obituary was not returned. When her descendants were finally located, they declined to come to Lusk and simply ordered Dell's body to be cremated, even though her estate was worth over $1 million. And in 2005, after a long search for the burial records of the generous Madam Rachel Urban of Park City, Utah, historian Gary Kimball finally located what many historians had not. The records for Rachel were well hidden, and certain others had been erased or half-entered. If not for Kimball's research, Rachel, who died clear back in 1933, might have been forgotten. But she is clearly remembered now. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. Print the Legend by Steve Friesen. Mass media dominates Brian LaBelle's Old West auction in Mesa, Arizona. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend, a newspaper man famously said in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. The most critical word in that sentence is print. It was mass media that made legends into facts and facts into legends in the Old West. The settlement of the American West coincided with the publishing explosion. Newspapers, weeklies, and dime novels sprang up everywhere, and their readers loved stories of the West. Improvements in lithography also ushered in a golden age of advertising posters, usually plastered on any flat surface in a community. By the time the U.S. Census Bureau declared the frontier was over in 1890, the West was already well embedded in the American consciousness, thanks to the promotion of Wild West shows and other things Western by the media. Brian LaBelle's Old West auctions consistently provide the artifacts associated with this rise of the mass media West. His first auctions were held in Cody, Wyoming, home of Buffalo Bill Cody, so it is not surprising that he cut his teeth selling artifacts from Buffalo Bill and other Wild West show entrepreneurs. LaBelle's Old West show and auction, held in Mesa, Arizona, from January 20th to 21st, did not disappoint in that regard. There were numerous photographs and programs from Buffalo Bill's Wild West, as well as from shows staged by the 101 Ranch, Pawnee Bill, Tim McCoy, Tom Mix, and others. The popularity of Wild West shows contributed to the rise of Western movies. Memorabilia from stars like Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, and Gene Autry sold well at the Mesa auction, as did cowboy hats from James Coburn, Audie Murphy, and William S. Hart. No 19th century cowboy would have ridden on a highly decorated saddle, used silver inlaid Crockett spurs, or worn decorative tasseled shirts on the range. Those were mainly adopted by the cowboys in the Wild West shows, parades, and the movies. Like the hats worn by Western movie stars, they were influenced by the popular mass media vision of the West. All attract collectors today. It was the media that popularized the West and its stories. From a lithograph advertising Buffalo Bill's Wild West, to Bolin saddles, to a painting used as a prop on the set of the television series Yellowstone. Artifacts from that popular West were featured at Brian LaBelle's Old West auction in Mesa this past January. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. A Proud Heritage Saved, Texas Style, by Jana Bombersback. Nobody surprised, it's so big and so bold. It started during a visit to a Norway museum in the 1960s, when Texas Tech University president Grover Murray wondered why he couldn't have a similar display back home, focusing on the planet's semi-arid regions, Africa, Asia, Australia, America's West. He found that Texas ranchers thought this was the best idea since sliced bread, and it was the American West piece that took off. Today, Texas Tech University in Lubbock houses the National Ranching Heritage Center that tells the story of ranching in the American West over the past 200 years. In 1977, the center hired its first staff and got a twofer. Historian and archaeologist William Curry Holden became the first director, while his wife Frances was the chief fundraiser in the early days. Christine Devitt, an heiress to the Mallet Ranch, loved the center so much, she gave the first $200,000 to get things rolling. Her sister Helen was also a main supporter, as was the late Ann Marion. This probably wouldn't exist without these three women, says Executive Director Jim Brett Campbell. This has been a labor of love for the ranching industry. It shows their true love for their heritage, their culture, and their values. The center today is massive. On 27 acres, it includes a 44,000-square-foot main museum, 7 main galleries, and a mile and a half of hard-surface walkways through 55 historic buildings that have been restored and outfitted as they would have been in their day. Campbell brags that ranchers not only donated structures, log cabins to barns to horse sheds to windmills to a schoolhouse to a 1909 Victorian mansion to a corral building from the 1700s, but also donated the funds to move the buildings to the campus. Along the way, they created the Ranching Heritage Association that today has 1,500 members in 38 states. This has become like a mission of the ranching community, Campbell notes, and it already has solidified its legacy. Our current members are descendants of the original founders. Our current president, Mark Kirkpatrick, is the grandson of John Lott, who was actively involved from the start. Kirkpatrick is also related to C.C. Slaughter, who once owned over 1 million acres in these parts. And they're raring to grow again, thanks to a $3.5 million gift from the Johnny Cash Foundation, which will help finance an $8.2 million Cash Ranch Life Learning Center. There are 20 other supporters for this indoor-outdoor interactive center that will teach the public about modern ranching through the eyes of Hank the Cowdog, a special series by author John Erickson. Campbell says the center currently attracts 65,000 visitors a year and hosts 6,000 to 8,000 school children on tours, and they think the new Cash Center will double those numbers. The center is open 7 days a week. More information is available from ranchingheritage.org. Jana Bommersback has earned recognition as Arizona's Journalist of the Year and won an Emmy and 2 Lifetime Achievement Awards. She co-wrote the Emmy-winning Outrageous Arizona and has written 3 true crime books, a children's book, and the historical novel Cattle Kate. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. Barbarians at the Quartz Rock by Mark Boardman. A crowd celebrated the first shot poured on Prescott's Whiskey Row. Then and now, Prescott, Arizona's great calling card has been Whiskey Row. For nearly 160 years, it has been a center for entertainment, libation, and even a little bit of history. And it all started in 1864. Entrepreneur William Hardy was the man with the vision. He saw a town that was recently named the territorial capital. It also had an army post, Fort Whipple, nearby. A lot of people with a lot of thirst would be coming to Prescott, and Hardy wanted to profit in that. And so he opened the Quartz Rock on November 14, 1864. The event drew a large crowd, in part because the saloon was offering a sampling of liquors on the house. It also featured the best billiard table in town. The opening was a huge success. There to enjoy the festivities was a group self-proclaimed as the Barbarians. Contrary to their name, the members were some of the leading lights in Arizona territory. Judge William Barry, Governor John Goodwin, Secretary of the Territory Richard McCormick, and several officers from Fort Whipple. The debut of the Quartz Rock coincided with another glorious event in the annals of the Barbarians. The night before, Arizona's first Speaker of the House, William C. Jones, entered into wedded bliss with Caroline Stevens. It had been a whirlwind courting, as Stevens and her family had been in Prescott for around 6 weeks. It also got local tongues wagging, since Jones was 55 years old, and his blushing bride was just 15. The Barbarians celebrated by mocking the pair, even breaking into the home where they were enjoying their nuptial privacy. The kidding apparently had an impact. Mr. and Mrs. Jones left for Tucson the next day, only to return the next April. They stayed in Prescott for another month before Jones ran off, leaving his teen bride behind. But back to the Barbarians' favorite watering hole. The Quartz Rock quickly became the social place in town, attracting the best and worst clientele. Founder Hardy, who never really lived in Prescott, turned to John J.P. Burke to run the place. Already a popular figure, Burke later became a lawman, founder of the Prescott Hotel, county recorder, and the father-in-law of future Cochise County Sheriff John Behan. Burke was ably assisted in the Quartz Rock operation by bartenders Doc and Joe, again, familiar and popular figures who helped create a genial atmosphere in the place. But it wasn't always peaceful. What's believed to have been the town's first murder occurred there in 1867 when a card game turned deadly. Local pioneer William Murray was shot down by young hardcase George Crafts. That same year, William Hardy sold the Quartz Rock to one of his bartenders for $6,600. Meantime, other purveyors followed in the footsteps of Hardy. Numerous other saloons opened, most of them within a block or so of the Quartz Rock. It was the beginning of Whiskey Row, but it suffered from issues that would plague the area for decades, like no fire department or available water supply. In 1871, a fire started in the saloon. Several kegs of whiskey exploded, adding to the conflagration. A determined effort by locals managed to limit the damage, but the Quartz Rock was nothing but rubble. And for whatever the reason, the current ownership decided not to rebuild. Thanks to Whiskey Row historian Bradley Courtney for his help with this column. His book, Prescott's Original Whiskey Row, has more tales of the noted block. True West Magazine, May 2023. Bards, Bison, and Bowlers by Marshall Trimble. Ask the Marshal. Question: what kind of reception did traveling entertainment groups receive in the West? Gloria Mata, Phoenix, Arizona. They were very popular in the entertainment-starved West, and the good ones made a lot of money. They ranged from Shakespearean troupes to minstrel shows to circus and equestrian acts. Pretty women were the most popular because of a dearth of females on the frontier, and many became very rich. Caroline Chapman was one of the first real actresses to head west. Following her first performance in San Francisco, the audience carpeted the stage with poke sacks filled with gold. Maria Eliza Rosanna Gilbert from Limerick, Ireland, took the stage as the exotic Lola Montez and became quite rich doing her spider dance, and there were many, many more. Question: what is known about Billy the Kid's early years? Richard Klingenberger, Buda, Texas. For the most part, they are a mystery. The kid's birth name was William Henry McCarty, Jr. His birthplace is not certain, maybe New York City. His family apparently lived in Indianapolis for a time, but little is known about that period. Billy had a brother, or maybe a half-brother, named Joseph, who was a gambler. The kid began calling himself William H. Bonney, but where he got the alias is unknown. Hopefully more research will find more info on Billy. Question: how did the Transcontinental Railroad affect the Bison? Robert Grace, Brooklyn, New York. The Bison were the commissary for the Plains Indians. Since there were so few resources on the plains, the Indians developed skills to use as much of the great beasts as possible. The land grants that the railroad companies were given took away land from the Plains Indians. The grants also greatly disrupted buffalo hunting, as fences around the new white settlers' lands and the railroad blocked the buffalo migrations. Now the white hide hunters could travel by rail to hunt, many just for sport. Others sought the fur for coats and other clothing, and the hides were used to make machine belts for the burgeoning Industrial Revolution. By 1900, naturalists estimated that fewer than 1,000 bison remained in the West. Question: when did bowling appear in Arizona? Tom Barker, Kansas City, Missouri. The earliest bowling alley I found in Arizona was Vogan's in Tombstone in 1879. The town also boasted four churches, an ice house, a school, two banks, three newspapers, and an ice cream parlor. That's alongside 110 saloons, 14 gambling halls, and numerous dance halls and brothels. Question: what do you know about Clay Buford, the noted Arizona pioneer? James Collins, Tucson, Arizona. Clay Buford was not his real name. He was born Wilford C. Bridwell, but changed his name to Clay Buford when he ran away from home at the age of 14 to enlist in the Confederate Army. He then had a distinguished career during the Apache Wars in the early 1870s. Afterward, in 1874, John Clum hired him as chief of Indian police at San Carlos, where he played a role in the dramatic capture of Geronimo and Victorio at Ojo Caliente. For that, Buford received a Medal of Honor. He followed that up by becoming a successful rancher and miner. In 1879, he formally changed his name back to Bridwell, then served in the 1885 session of the Arizona Territorial Legislature. Buford, or Bridwell, died in Los Angeles in 1905. This is Michael reading from True West Magazine's Archives, May 1988 edition. The Last Sheepman-Cattleman War by Andre Nelson. It was 10 p.m., April 2nd, 1909. The place, Ten Sleep, Wyoming. The moonlight so intense that earlier that evening, Bounce Helmer had commented on it to the other sheep herders. The light was so bright that Bounce could see the colors on the saddle blanket he had hung over the tailgate of the wagon. Yet even in the bright moonlight, he was not able to identify the cowboys who suddenly swooped on their camp. They were all masked. The sheep herders had been expecting trouble ever since they had crossed the cattleman's deadline and driven their sheep north into the valley of the Badlands. Now, however, the two bands of sheep, totaling 3,500, were bedded down just 6 miles from their destination of Ten Sleep, and it was hoped that the cattleman's threats would prove empty. That was not to be. These raiders did not intend merely to kill a few sheep and frighten the sheep herders. Feelings ran deeper than that. This was a vendetta against one of their former members, a cattleman turned sheepman. The results would be tragic. When the moon rose again, it would look down on dead men, smoldering wagons, and scattered groups of dying sheep. The cattleman's bitter animosity against the sheepmen and the reasons for the climactic battle dated back to the opening of the West. The causes of their antagonism were many, but the basic one was economics. The cattlemen simply did not want the sheep competing for the available range. After a period of years, however, an uneasy truce had been reached between the two warring factions, and tension between cattle and sheep interests in Wyoming had subsided. That long peace might have continued despite the movement of the sheep herd into the Norwood Valley had it not been for one of the sheepmen's trail bosses, Joe Emge. Emge's arrogant, abrasive personality made him enemies among the cattlemen. More important, he once had been a cattleman himself. In the past, he had been one of the most virulent in damning the sheepmen. He even had set the deadline he now planned to violate. Emge had also taken part in battles against the sheepmen, including one against his present partner on this drive, Joe Allamand. Emge's friends were angered when they heard he was planning to move sheep onto the range. Several of them approached him and warned him against moving the animals across the deadline. He truculently replied that he would move the herd across the 30-mile strip, despite any effort to stop him. Joe Allamand, the other leader on the drive, was a man well-liked by his neighbors. He had married a local girl, and he had many close contacts in the valley. The only reason he had asked Emge to join in on the drive was that he needed the cattleman's financial backing. Had Allamand not included Emge, the battle and its traumatic aftermath probably never would have happened. However, Emge had thrown down the gauntlet, and as the herd moved out, tensions mounted in the valley. Allamand, Emge, and two Frenchmen, one of them named Jules Lazier, were with the first band of sheep. The second group was brought along in the rear by Bounce Helmer and a French camp tender, Pete Caffarel. Ironically, Bounce's stepfather and stepuncle were cattlemen Jake and Willie Goodrich. The herd moved through the Badlands in defiance of the cattlemen's well-known warning. They began their four-day journey toward Ten Sleep, where the sheep were to be sheared and turned out to graze. The party lines between ranches were busy relaying information on their progress. Apparently, the cattlemen had given tacit approval to their cowhands to make the raid, with the implication that they would be given protection if needed. With that encouragement from their employers, some cowboys soon formed a group to attack the sheep herders. As most of the cattlemen's animosity was directed at Joe Emge, the raiders believed his death would be a warning enough to the sheep herders and would halt the drive. The raiders then drew lots to see who would shoot Emge. The cowboy who won the draw, or lost it, depending on your point of view, rode up into Bud Kimball Draw on the morning of April 2nd to ambush Emge. But he failed in his attempt, claiming that Emge had already passed through the draw by the time he had arrived. By chance, the rancher he later told this to had seen the gunman ride into and out of the draw that morning, an hour after the cowboy had left the draw. Emge had ridden out, hazing a string of horses, and had stopped at the rancher's home for lunch. At any rate, Emge was not killed that morning, and the cowboy joined his friends at the Keys Ranch for the next step in the unfolding drama. As Emge ate at the ranch, he said he believed the worst of the trip was over. He thought the group would arrive safely, as they were within 6 miles of their ranches. He had hired two Frenchmen as gunmen, but had paid one of them off that morning, for in his opinion, the other would be enough protection for the rest of the trip. He added that all during the drive, none of the party had slept in their wagons or near the campsite, but had moved away at least half a mile, as they expected an attack at any time. Now, he apparently believed, they could let their guard down. As he described the trip, the tensions of the drive were revealed, for he began to cry. The rancher's daughter, 10 years old at the time, still recalls the incident vividly, as it was the first time she had ever seen a man cry. Another event, she recalled, still irritates her. Her brother's horse had been borrowed by one of the raiders that night of the raid and was found lathered and sweat-stained in the corral the next morning. Had it been killed in the melee, her brother would have been hard-pressed to prove his innocence. Having failed to have Emge bushwhacked in the canyon that morning, the leader of the group, who most conceded was George Sabin, led them at dusk from the Keys Ranch up to the bank of Spring Creek. The attackers tied their horses to saplings growing along the bank and waited until the two bands of sheep had bedded down for the night. Then they moved in quickly on both camps. Three of the masked gunmen rousted Bounce out of his sogan and ordered Pete out of his bed in the sheep wagon. The two men, rifles at their hands, were marched from the wagons. As they walked toward the Bighorn Mountains, one of the raiders ordered Pete to drop his coat, for he would not be needing it where he was going. Pete did so. A few steps further, the two were told to halt and lie face down on the ground. They obeyed. As though on signal, they heard repeating rifles open up on the other camp, where Emge, Allemand, and Lazier had been sleeping. The fusillade came to a ragged halt, and in the sudden stillness, Bounce heard one of the group say the men would not come out of the wagon. Another commented that perhaps they could not. Then Alexander, a lodge brother of Allemand, shouted, "Come on out, Allemand. I'll see that you're not hurt." For a moment, there was no sound. Then either Emge or Allemand replied, "It is a hell of a time of the night to come out." At that time, the sheep herders apparently left the wagon. A flurry of shots were heard. Bounce heard Allemand groan. A few intermittent shots shattered the night, then silence. Bounce and Pete heard someone come running up from the other camp. There was a whispered hurry consultation. Bounce froze as he heard one of their captors propose, "Kill these two. They'll talk." At that point, the leader walked over. He cursed, saying events had not gone as planned. Overriding the objections of the others, he ordered that neither Bounce nor Pete was to be killed. The sheepmen were told to get on their feet. As they did, they heard the crackling of fire as the sheep wagon and supplies in the other camp were burned. Because of the fire's acrid odor, both men assumed the bodies of some sheep must have been thrown into the flames. The raiders who had attacked the Emge Allemand camp now joined the group around Bounce and Pete. They threw coal oil on the supply wagon and sheep wagon and set them ablaze. All equipment, harnesses, blankets, and even a saddle were thrown into the fire. When one man bent over to untie the buggy so it could be pushed into the fire, his mask momentarily fell. Bounce recognized him as Ed Eaton, a cowboy with whom he had worked on roundups. Having burned wagons, equipment, and supplies, the cowpunchers rounded up as many sheep as they could and drove them off a cliff into a ravine. The fall and the resulting panic killed most of them. Those that survived were in the following days gathered up by children of the ranchers, and later most of them were turned over to a sheep herder to hold for the Emge Alamond estate. In the meantime, the commotion had not gone unnoticed by the owners of the Greet Ranch, which was the closest cabin to the scene. When gunshots erupted, two men rushed to the front of the cabin. To their amazement, they were fired on, and in their hasty scramble for shelter, one of them fell through the glass window of the cabin. They all remained inside until morning. Their work finished for the night, the raiders freed the two prisoners. Their last orders were that they should head south, keep going, and forget what they had what had happened. In view of the bloody evidence lying about, that would be difficult. About 2 a.m., with his bare feet cut, blistered, and painful, Bounce arrived at his stepfather's ranch. Early that same morning, when there was no sound from the shepherd's camp except the bleating of a few bewildered sheep, the men at the Greet Ranch sent for another rancher, Mr. S. Harvard, who lived nearby and was recognized as the informal leader of the valley. At the camp, they found only smoldering ashes and three charred bodies. Joe Alamond was sprawled under the double trees of the wagon where he had fallen. His body was not so badly burned that it could not be identified readily. He had been shot. Later, however, his death was attributed not to bullet wounds, but to a slash across his throat, made by a shovel. Imge's charred torso lay in the still-burning embers. Identification could only be made by the two gold teeth found near the skull. By the process of elimination, the blackened remains of the third man were assumed to be those of the Frenchman, Jules Lazier. The men took Alamond's body to the Greet cabin, where it would be out of the sun, and weighted down the eyelids with heavy coins. As the raiders had cut the telephone lines on both sides of the Greet ranch house, a rider had to be sent into town to notify the sheriff of the battle at Ten Sleep. On the morning of April 3rd, the little town of Norwood awakened to a flood of rumors. In the distance, feeble, dying plumes of smoke drifted up from the foot of the Bighorn Mountains. Yet it was not until the rider came in from the Greet Ranch that some of the facts emerged. There must have been few who were comfortable with the news. As the story was told and retold, people avoided each other's eyes, for few knew who had been involved in the raid, and the others were not anxious to find out. Almost all of them had been good neighbors of the dead men, their main point of dispute being that they did not want sheep around. As the townspeople murmured among themselves about the battle, a consensus began to emerge that shooting up a herd of sheep was one thing, but the bloody confrontation at Ten Sleep was something the law could not ignore. A climate of law and order was reaching into the West, and an open season on sheep herders could not be permitted. When the citizens' reaction to the shootings reached the governor, he offered a $500 reward for the capture of those responsible. The Wyoming Wool Growers Association offered a $1,000 reward, later raised to $2,000. In May, at Basin, Wyoming, the grand jury was called into session to consider the case. In the meantime, the cattlemen were in a quandary. While they perhaps had not expected events to turn out as they had, they still felt an obligation to help the perpetrators. So even though no defendants had been named, they quickly retained the services of all of the lawyers in the vicinity. Some of them would do nothing in the case, but at least the prosecution could not use them. When the grand jury finally met, it might have been a difficult task finding the facts of the case had it not been for Leroy Brink. Brink was one of the cowboys involved in the battle, and he could not keep quiet. He was a tough, salty, quarrelsome man who had been wintering at the ranch of Bounce's step-uncle, Willie Goodrich, doing chores for his keep. Upon his return to the bunkhouse after the battle, this garrulous cowboy could not refrain from telling the story to all he met. Among those he told were Goodrich and an old cowhand, Bill Arison. The grand jury subpoenaed Goodrich and Arison. Albert Keyes and Charles Ferris also were summoned. They had taken part in the battle and told all they knew. The information was enough to issue warrants for the arrest of 7 men. Those jailed were Leroy Brink, Ed Eaton, Tom Dixon, George Sabin, Albert Keyes, Charles Ferris, and M.A. Alexander. As soon as the men were named, Billy and Willie Goodrich were hidden for their own protection, as they were considered key witnesses for the prosecution. Feelings about the trial ran high, and some of those involved in gathering evidence against the defendants were warned not to pry too deeply. Several heavily armed cowboys with a mess wagon moved into Basin. The authorities heard that as many as 10 more bands might move into the small town, so a company of militia was called in to reduce the possibility of disturbances during the trial. In October 1909, preparations for the trial were made. Prior to the selection of the jury, the cattlemen had made it widely known that they would not be satisfied with a verdict other than not guilty. Obviously, those selected for the jury knew this. After the jury had been chosen, however, the method of their selection was ruled incorrect. Some believed that with the first jurors, the defense might have gained a hung jury. The selection of new jurors may have changed the trial's outcome. The court proceedings dragged on through days of macabre evidence. At last, to the relief of many who had feared they might be called on to testify, the trial came to a close. On November 19th, 1909, the final act of the 10-sleep confrontation took place with the jury finding 5 defendants guilty. A yellowing newspaper clipping of that date describes the courtroom scene. When Judge C.H. Parmley broached plans for the terms of the sentencing, Brinks is quoted as saying, with tears streaming down his face, "For God's sake, save the boys and hang me." "No," cried George Sabin. "If you can't be saved, we will all hang from the same tree." George Sabin and M.A. Alexander each received 20-year sentences. Ed Eaton and Thomas Dixon got 3 years for arson. And Leroy Brink was sentenced to life for the murder of Alamand. The men went to the Wyoming penitentiary. Sabin was put on a road gang shortly after appearing at the penitentiary and disappeared. He was never caught. It was rumored that he went to Canada or Mexico and eventually returned to the cattle business. Brink had been assigned to the same road gang as Sabin, and he too escaped. He surfaced in Canada, where his activities brought him to the attention of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and he was returned to the Wyoming penitentiary. When Dixon was released from the confinement, he drifted to Oklahoma, where he was killed in an accident. Alexander served part of his term, was released, and returned to the valley, where he died. Ed Eaton, upon his release, also remained in Wyoming. Due to their cooperation with the grand jury, Keyes and Ferris were not sentenced. As soon after the trial as they could, they left for Montana. Apparently, they lived out the rest of their lives there. As for the two key witnesses, some people in the valley felt animosity towards Willie Goodrich, believing he had testified solely for a share of the reward money. He was ostracized by his neighbors and had to sell his ranch and leave the valley. Bounce continued to follow the lonely life of a sheep herder until he died in the valley many years later. This last convulsive battle between two conflicting interests in the Old West had several bizarre after effects. After the funeral services at Alamand's ranch, one of the young nieces remained at the ranch for the night. Shortly after the girl had gone to bed, she was awakened and looked out her window towards the rocky hill looming over the ranch house. Moonlight flooded the outcropping, and in its ghostly radiance, she saw a man on a white horse silhouetted at the top of the hill. Horse and rider remained there all night, motionless. When approached, both man and horse disappeared. Was the rider there to frighten or to protect? The French camp tender, Pete Cafferel, was inexplicably followed back to his native country by the events of that traumatic night. When he returned to France, he reportedly was put in jail. The charge was that he had convinced Jules to go with him to work in the Wild West, and therefore was responsible for his death. It was also reported that Jules Lazier was on a leave of absence from the French army, and due to the circumstances of his death, the United States government would be obligated to make a financial settlement with his family. Stories of the settlement paid vary, the most commonly quoted total being $25,000. The ripple effect of the events that night at Ten Sleep also brought tragedy to another person, an outsider, who had not been involved in the raid. That was the old cowboy, Bill Arison. He was a pleasant, unassuming person, liked by all. Because Brink had boasted to him about the raid and given him intimate details of what had taken place, Arison was summoned to testify before the grand jury. On the evening before he was to appear, Arison had headed out of Basin for a walk. A young ranch hand, uninvited, went with him, and they engaged in idle talk. As it grew late, Arison suggested the young man return to town, and Bill continued his walk. The next morning, he was found dead by a haystack. The gun at his side belonged to Brink. It is believed Arison had taken the gun and killed himself because of his anguish at having to appear in court and give harmful evidence against his friends. Ironically, the one man who may have been directly responsible for the murder of Allemand was never sentenced, according to a newspaper account written after the trial. Prior to sentencing Brink, he had asked to see Judge Parmley privately. He told the judge that it was Ferris who had killed Allemand. If true, it was a mockery of fate that Ferris, who had confessed details of the raid to the grand jury, was free, while Brink was sentenced to life in prison. However, Brink outlived all the other defendants, and as most of the ranchers throughout the valley signed a petition circulated by his sister, he was eventually freed. Perhaps the futility of the last cattleman-sheepman ranch war may be summed up in a comment attributed to Brink long after the raid. In the book Ten Sleep and No Rest, he's quoted as having said, "I thought I was right at the time, but I guess I wasn't." In retrospect, many others who have been directly or indirectly involved in that range war at Ten Sleep would no doubt echo those words. Sources. This article is based on contemporary newspaper accounts and information provided by Nellie Redland, whose father led the ranchers to the site of the killing the next morning, too late to save Allemand and Imj. Mrs. Redland's daughter, Jo Redland, provided additional details. Ten Sleep and No Rest by Jack Gage was also consulted.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.